The Dream of a Ridiculous Man by Fyodor Dostoevsky, Chapter 4. Well, you see, again, let me repeat. All right. Let us assume it was only a dream, but the sensation of the love of those innocent and beautiful people has remained with me forever, and I can feel that their love is even now flowing out to me from over there. I have seen them myself. I have known them thoroughly and been convinced. I loved them and I suffered for them afterwards. Oh, I knew at once, even all the time, that there were many things about them I should never be able to understand. To me, a modern Russian progressive and a despicable citizen of Petersburg, it seemed inexplicable that, knowing so much, they knew nothing of our science, for instance. But I soon realized that their knowledge was derived from and fostered by emotions other than those to which we were accustomed on Earth, and that their aspirations, too, were quite different. They desired nothing. They were at peace with themselves. They did not strive to gain knowledge of life as we strive to understand it, because their lives were full. But their knowledge was higher and deeper than the knowledge we derive from our science. For our science seeks to explain what life is and strives to understand it in order to teach others how to live, while they knew how to live without science. I understood that, but I couldn't understand their knowledge. They pointed out their trees to me, and I could not understand the intense love with which they looked on them. It was as though they were talking with beings like themselves. And you know, I don't think I am exaggerating in saying that they talked with them. Yes, they had discovered their language, and I am sure the trees understood them. They looked upon all nature like that, the animals which lived peaceably with them and did not attack them, but loved them, conquered by their love for them. They pointed out the stars to me and talked to me about them in a way that I could not understand, but I am certain that in some curious way they commuted with the stars in the heavens, not only in thought, but in some actual, living way. Oh, these people were not concerned whether I understood them or not. They loved me without it. But I too knew that they would never be able to understand me. And for that reason, I hardly ever spoke to them about our Earth. I merely kissed the Earth on which they lived in their presence and worshipped them without any words. And they saw that, and they let me worship them without being ashamed that I was worshipping them, for they themselves loved much. They did not suffer for me when, weeping, I sometimes kissed their feet, for in their hearts they were joyfully aware of the strong affection with which they would return my love. At times I asked myself in amazement how they had managed never to offend a person like me, and not once arouse in a person like me a feeling of jealousy and envy. Many times I asked myself how I, a braggart and a liar, could refrain from telling them all I knew of science and philosophy, of which, of course, they had no idea. How it had never occurred to me to impress them with my store of learning, or impart my learning to them, out of the love I bore them. They were playful and high-spirited, like children. They wandered about their beautiful woods and groves. They sang their beautiful songs. They lived on simple food, the fruits of their trees, the honey from their woods, and the milk of the animals that loved them. To obtain their food and clothes, they did not work very hard or long. They knew love, and they begot children, but I never noticed in any of them those outbursts of cruel sensuality which overtake almost everybody on our Earth, whether man or woman, and are the only source of almost every sin of our human race. They rejoiced in their newborn children as new sharers in their bliss.
There were no quarrels or jealousy among them, and they did not even know what the words meant. Their children were the children of them all, for they were all one family. There was scarcely any illness among them, though there was death. But their old people died peacefully, as though falling asleep, surrounded by the people who took leave of them, blessing them and smiling at them, and themselves receiving with bright smiles the farewell wishes of their friends. I never saw grief or tears on those occasions. What I did see was love that seemed to reach the point of rapture, but it was a gentle, self-sufficient, and contemplative rapture. There was reason to believe that they communicated with the departed after death, and that their earthly union was not cut short by death. They found it almost impossible to understand me when I questioned them about life eternal, but apparently they were so convinced of it in their minds that for them it was no question at all. They had no places of worship, but they had a certain awareness of a constant, uninterrupted, and living union with the universe at large. They had no specific religions, but instead they had a certain knowledge that when their earthly joy had reached the limits imposed upon it by nature, they, both the living and the dead, would reach a state of still closer communion with the universe at large. They looked forward to that moment with joy, but without haste and without pining for it, as though already possessing it in the vague stirrings of their hearts, which they then communicated to each other. In the evening, before going to sleep, they were fond of gathering together and singing in melodious and harmonious choirs. In their songs, they expressed all the sensations the parting day had given them. They praised it and bade it farewell. They praised nature, the earth, the sea, and the woods. They were also fond of composing songs about one another, and they praised each other like children. Their songs were very simple, but they sprang straight from the heart, and they touched the heart. And not only in their songs alone, but they seemed to spend all their lives in perpetual praise of one another. It seemed to be a universal and all-embracing love for each other. Some of their songs were solemn and ecstatic, and I was scarcely able to understand them at all. While understanding the words, I could never entirely fathom their meaning. It remained somehow beyond the grasp of my reason, and yet it sank unconsciously deeper and deeper into my heart. I often told them that I had had a presentiment of it years ago, and that all that joy and glory had been perceived by me while I was still on our earth as a nostalgic yearning, bordering at times on unendurably poignant sorrow, that I had had a presentiment of them all, and of their glory in the dreams of my heart, and in the reveries of my soul, that often on our earth I could not look at the setting sun without tears, that there always was a sharp pang of anguish in my hatred of the men of our earth. Why could I not hate them without loving them too? Why could I not forgive them? And in my love for them too, there was a sharp pang of anguish. Why could I not love them without hating them? They listened to me, and I could tell that they did not know what I was talking about. But I was not sorry to have spoken to them of it, for I knew that they appreciated how much and how anxiously I yearned for those I had forsaken. Oh yes, when they looked at me with their dear eyes full of love, when I realized that in their presence my heart too became as innocent and truthful as theirs, I did not regret my inability to understand them either. The sensation of the fullness of life left me breathless, and I worshipped them in silence. Oh, everyone laughs in my face now, and everyone assures me that I could not possibly have seen and felt anything so definite, but was merely conscious of a sensation that arose in my own feverish heart, and that I invented all those details myself when I woke up. and when I told them that they were probably right, good lord, what mess that admission of mine caused, and how they laughed at me. Why, of course, I was overpowered by the mere sensation of that dream, and it alone survived my sorely wounded heart. But nonetheless, the real shapes and forms of my dream, that is, those I actually saw at the very time of my dream, were filled with such harmony, and were so enchanting and beautiful, and so intensely true, that on awakening I was indeed unable to clothe them in our feeble words, so that they were bound, as it were, to become blurred in my mind. So it is any wonder that perhaps unconsciously I was myself afterwards driven to make up the details which I could not help distorting, particularly in view of my passionate desire to convey some of them at least as quickly as I could. But that does not mean that I have no right to believe that it all did happen. As a matter of fact, it was quite possibly 1,000 times better, brighter, and more joyful than I describe it. What if it was only a dream? All that could possibly not have been. And do you know, I think I'll tell you a secret. Perhaps it was no dream at all. For what happened afterwards was so awful, so horribly true, that it couldn't possibly have been a mere coinage of my brain seen in a dream. Granted that my heart was responsible for my dream, but could my heart alone have been responsible for the awful truth of what happened to me afterwards? Surely my paltry heart and my vacillating and trivial mind could not have risen to such a revelation of truth. Oh, judge for yourselves. I have been concealing it all the time. But now I will tell you the whole truth. The fact is, I corrupted them all.